Today's episode of Higher Learning is with Curtis Weeks, the CEO of New Reach Education. I work with Curtis back at his time at Restaurant Brands International, and he's got so much great insights to teach us and to learn from. He's an operating guru who's come into an organization like New Reach Education, building community. He has so many great ideas around how you get great talent in the organization, how do you go in and take a company from here to there, and also a bunch of insights around what it was like to work at Walmart. Curtis has so much to say. I am so excited for you all to hear this episode and take a listen for yourself.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid, and today we have a very special guest. Today we are joined by Curtis Weeks. Curtis is the Chief Executive Officer at New Reach Education. Curtis, how are you doing today?
I'm outstanding. Thank you, Oz. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm really appreciative of you doing this. I know we worked together a way long time ago back when you were at Restaurant Brands International. So I'm so excited that we're getting to reconnect like this. I'm also excited for you in this role as CEO, obviously, at New Reach Education. I'm interested. Tell us a little bit. Why did you join New Reach and tell us a little bit about the organization?
Yeah, absolutely. To be honest, it's been an absolutely fun 3 years that I've been here. I started out as our COO and I came on board, and the company was probably about 4 or 5 years old at the time. And so it was kind of starting to go through some of those weird little growing pains of, it's not really a startup anymore, but you can say it's a startup because it's convenient, because then you don't have to have the SOPs. But really wanted to progress kind of into that small to medium size. And so some of the areas that in my career that I've been a little more successful is figuring out how to take some of that smaller, maybe a little bit more undisciplined, and figure out how to get it into a very scalable solution. And so that's super fun. And so that's why I was brought on board. But what New Reach does is we're really kind of a house of brands. And so we are set up to provide really cool educational and community products to folks who are looking to truly transform their lives. And so we have products that are in the real estate investment space, some in publishing, how to set up kind of your own bookkeeping course, how to learn and earn how to use business credit. And so we do a lot of things to help folks with that kind of inner entrepreneurial spirit. They need to figure out how to focus a little bit, learn a little bit of the tactics, techniques, and set up their business so that they can be more successful. And so it's a super, super fun place to operate, because we're working with folks who want to join us because they have really big visions for themselves and we want to help them achieve those. So it's a lot of fun.
I love that. Now, listen, that's fantastic. I'm going to take this in a little bit of a different direction because my curiosity is getting the best of me. So you talked a little bit about this being in a company that's going from a startup, but not quite an enterprise, but you're getting to this point where you need to scale. And I'll be honest with you, like, we're looking at how we get more operationally disciplined ourselves as a company, because what got you here won't get you there. And many of the things and people that got you to a certain place might be very different as you go forward, as you grow the company. So I'm just interested, this sounds like a specialty of yours. What kind of operating principles when you're coming into an organization like that, maybe one that's a little bit more undisciplined or inconsistent and needs some of that rigidity, there's a big change management impact there. So I'm just interested, what's kind of your operating principles, core philosophy going into that environment? What are the things you're prioritizing up front?
Yeah, so to be honest, Oz, I think there's two things that are probably the most consistent in terms of how I've been able to implement them, and they've had positive effects. And the first one is really focused around the idea that I think you need to earn the right to make recommendations. And so I've worked at Walmart, I worked at for the U.S. Air Force, both pretty large organizations, and you're talking north of 2 million people. And so if someone in a small organization says, oh, that won't work for us because, or, hey, you don't know what we're doing because, there can be a lot of internal friction to that. And so it's my job as a person who comes onto the team to earn the right to make recommendations. And so I've always believed that the best way that I can do that is to become an expert in the way that it's currently done. It's not to come in and say, hey, I know what's better. Hey, this worked for another company, let's go do it now. But really spend a month or so and become an expert in how the company currently does it. Then I can gain far better perspective, and it's a whole lot easier to influence things. And the reality is my initial judgments sometimes are a little bit wrong because I don't understand the context or understand why we are where we are. And so if I can spend that month and really invest to learn it, I'm in better shape. The second thing is, as companies grow from small to, or from kind of the micro to small, we've got to apply structure, but that structure should not feel incredibly bureaucratic. And so it's kind of a silly phrase of, But what I typically offer is my goal is to set guardrails up, not put handcuffs on people. I want people to run as fast as they can, be as amazing as they've always been, but give them the confines and the construct so that what they're doing is constructive and they don't fall off the cliff. And so there's a little bit of faith that I'm asking for in them because often it all feels like handcuffs. So
I
those are two
absolutely
things I
love
think are
that.
helpful.
I love that. Earn the right to make recommendations and then applying guardrails, not handcuffs. I will always remember that. I have a lot of founders in my community and network, and I know that listen to this, that they're going to get a lot out of that. That's exceptional advice, Curtis. I appreciate you giving it to us. I'm always interested about the career journey. To me, a resume tells 10% of the story. The story, the journey behind why you made the decision, where you went, where you are. You worked at, you mentioned Walmart, Restaurant Brands International, the Air Force, among other organizations. Is there one that stood out where you learned the most? And then maybe is there one that stood out from a cultural perspective? Maybe they're the same, maybe they're different.
It's interesting. I'm actually working on something right now to try to document some of the lessons that I've learned and give credit to the folks that have purposefully invested in me. And so it's really fun because as I look back, every organization and every person that I've worked with has made an investment in me. And some of them have been incredibly purposeful in terms of a leadership development track, or hey, you seem young and dumb and I need to teach you this right now. Or maybe they don't do it quite the most right way, but I can learn from that. And so literally it's been almost 30 years of me just trying to be a very active listener as a practitioner of what I would call leadership, so that I can learn and earn those things and I can apply them going forward and I can continue to refine what I learn. And so honestly, every single job, every month, every year, I've learned different things. The military certainly taught me structure and taught me the importance of hierarchy. And so in general, the military needs to work in an environment that's in a combat space. And so in that, there's not a tremendous amount of time for dialogue in the combat environment. But one thing that I was really fortunate about in the Air Force is my entire time, I was always able to communicate with my supervisors and senior leaders to ask the questions of why. And because I was able to ask enough of those questions, even a highly disciplined environment, I was able to better execute their vision when they were away or communication was a little bit more challenged, which
Can I
is
interject
great.
there real quickly? I want to ask you a question because when I think of the military, I don't feel like it's always a place that accepts asking why. It's more like when I tell you to jump how high type situation or just get it done. So was that unique to the leaders you had, or is that different about the Air Force, or what? How is that, or is that just a complete misconception?
I think I was actually really fortunate. But I would say that the Air Force in general, and even the way I executed, is I always spent time for the why. And so I had office hours so people could ask me any question about why our mission's the way it is, because that always helped me better serve. Because when I understand the context, in the absence of a perfect, explicit go do X, I know that directionally that's where you want me to go. And so it's interesting because I actually really learned that from the Army. And so I was over in Turkey in between or in 2000 for about 6 months. And we were flying operations over northern Iraq. And so it would take about an hour and a half for the planes to get over there. And I started to think about Europe and about how difficult it is for the army and tanks because they have to start moving like weeks in advance. They're not going at 500 knots, so they can't get there super fast. And so often in the army, they need direction that says kind of go west. Where in the Air Force, and maybe I need you to head 271. Like that's the direction you need to go. West is good enough if it's going to take 3 weeks to get there. And so I think it's really important to understand how specific your direction needs to be. And so I think each branch of the service is a little bit different. I think the Marines is probably a little bit more line item of, hey, I need you to go execute this. The Air Force and the Navy, from my experience, has shown that there's a lot more time for the why. And I think the Army is somewhere in between. But all of the services that I've worked with have been highly invested in developing talent and leadership. And the only way to do that is to get people to understand the why. And so it doesn't matter if they're an officer or enlisted, the more time we can invest in the why and understand exactness and execution, the better off we'll be.
I love
And
that.
so I think that was the first part. Second part was company cultures. To be honest, I thought Walmart and the military were really similar.
Oh, wow.
And
Okay,
so
tell
the
me
Air
more.
Force. It's our core values were integrity first, service before self, and excellence in all you do. Walmart, they were really similar. They had four, but they were really guided under the same principle that we need to manage the way that we operate in a respectful way and serve. And so it didn't matter if it was a P&L that was tied to it, or it was purely an expense center in the military. Both of them were super, super tied together. And so it was a relatively easy transition for me. And so with 11 years in the Air Force, 7 years at Walmart, that's the better part of two decades that I was really fortunate to be a part of the culture that so many before had built. And so for the last few years, I've been trying to pull that forward into the smaller organizations that I've been in. And so it's been great.
I really love that. I love the comparison between Walmart and kind of the military organizations. I know that whenever I go and I meet somebody who spent any amount of time at Walmart, whether it be in operations, whether it be in HR, whether it be in finance, whatever it may be, I know I've got to be on my A game. I know I've got to be prepped. I've got to be ready to be in there. Some of the best and most challenging conversations I've had with people who have spent a lot of time at Walmart, because they do a really good job of building a system and integrating you into that system and then executing against it. And you have to do that when you have the market cap they do, they have the growth that they do, they have the value prop that they do. So that's really awesome to hear. And that sounds like both of those times in those different organizations have really shaped who you are. You've talked a lot about service. And so what I'm really interested in is, you mentioned to me in one of our pre-conversations, service is the reward. And I hadn't heard that before. I'm interested, what do you mean by that? And why do you think that's important for leaders in particular?
So I think that there is a slight philosophical choice that people have, is you can stand on one side or on the other. I've always believed that when someone hires me for a role, that was the reward that they gave me. They gave me the opportunity to serve, and they gave me the opportunity to excel and have some proximity to them as leaders so that I can learn from it. And so it's now my job to pay that back. It's not inherently like, hey, your job is to take care of me and you owe me this because I'm working for you. I think it's the other way around. And it's funny because it really kind of came to a head as I was thinking about fortune or misfortune one day. I was thinking about the people who are unfortunately maybe get in a car accident on the way home from work. And they're like, oh, I'm so unlucky. And they feel like they have a right to be more lucky the future weeks. Where I got thinking about it, I was like, wow, I didn't get in a car accident last night. Maybe that was the fortune. Maybe the fortune was not getting in the car accident. And so just like my fortune or my opportunity is to serve, and to do it with all my heart and my mind. And so in the way that I can serve and provide the reward to the people who invested in me, I kind of need to put my head down and be honored to go do that. If I feel entitled, I'm never going to be able to serve them in the way that they deserve. And so that's why for me, I really think service is the reward. I went through an interview process. Someone chose me to go do it. Someone handed me something that they believe is really important, whether it's the owner of the company or a mid-level manager. They're saying, Curtis, I'm asking you to go do this. And so that's a huge reward because they wouldn't give it to me if they didn't trust me.
Yeah. I don't want to overly generalize, but it leads me to a thought, right? I hate how we try to group generations and say Zoomers are like this and millennials are like this and boomers are like this. But I am so aligned with you on the services of reward and being a servant leader. And I think that has really helped me throughout my career and helped me ascend in my career in a lot of different ways. I'm wondering if you notice if that dynamic seems different with more of the early in career talent that you work with now or you see, and is there a way to kind of implement that into your culture, or do you just have to look for people that, even if it's a little bit harder to find, have that mentality when you're hiring? Like, how do you kind of balance that in terms of building an organization of people who see service as the reward?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think social media allows for mass communication. And so whether the message is a good message, a neutral message, or a bad message, the volume of that message is really high. And the reality is a person on their phone, no matter what age, they will get more communication through that phone or whatever that mechanism than I can give them. And so I can't be louder. I can't be more frequent, but I can be more purposeful. And so that's where I try to start is, so when I bring somebody on or I promote them into a new role, I'm a little bit more explicit in letting them know, hey, you're here because of the hard work that you've done, and we're trusting you to do more. It's not that you've inherently earned it just because you worked hard. You've earned it because you've shown the potential to continue to serve. And so I'm pretty clear about that. And so I don't want somebody to walk out being like, oh, wow, thank you so much. I couldn't do anything without you. But I want them to really understand that I'm placing massive trust in them. And for me, that's one of the best things that I can do. And so if I communicate that clearly, it usually works out pretty well.
I really love that. I think refocusing a promotion or giving somebody opportunity and less about, because sometimes you'll see that they take the approach of, I've arrived, or like, this was the goal. This is what I was trying to do. And yet we're putting you in this position because we believe you have the potential to fulfill it, but it's earned, not given. And you have to prove that day in and day out. And a service mentality is the best way to do that. I love that. That's great. That's great for management. That's great for people building cultures of high performance, but also one where employees feel engaged and developed. I love that. I think that's great stuff. Community is also very important to you. You mentioned to me at NewReach, you're very intentional around building community for the students. I want to understand what you mean by that. How do you improve the experience for students at NewReach?
Yeah, it's interesting. And so we're definitely in the, what I would say is a non-traditional educational path. And so someone who comes to us may actually not want to continue through formal education, but they want academics, but they also want a group of people that can help them succeed. They also want someone who's kind of a mentor that has gone to the top of the mountain and can show them the path. And so I think that's really important. I actually saw the exact same thing in B school. And so I went through at a time where cohorts were really important. And so there were five or six of us that seemed to go through every class together. And it was great. And they were all brilliant and all had different backgrounds. And they taught me as much as the professor at the front of the room. And so I got to experience the same thing that we as a company are trying to do in a traditional environment, but we're trying to do it in what's a little bit more of a non-traditional environment. And so several of the brands that we have 2, 5, or 15,000 members. And so, if they are purely reliant on kind of the industry leader to only be the person that gives them information, they're never going to be successful because they just can't touch that many people that often. Where if you've got a community of kind of like-minded folks with the focus of, hey, I want to be successful doing this type of stuff, they stand a really good chance. And so, if they're in a peer group of 5,000 people, they can collaborate. And that's one of the key parts to our focus at NewReach is collaboration over competition. So even in an environment where you may be thinking about like, hey, we both kind of want to buy that house, there's still good ways to collaborate on that. And so when we take the competition portion and move that to the side and we figure out that we can both advance by doing it together, we're in better shape. And so those are key components to what we think of in terms of the community. The other piece to it is we actually hold our community accountable. And so if you're acting like a little bunny foo-foo, we're going to tell you that. And so if you're not so nice, you don't get to participate anymore. It's not a you paid to play. You asked to enter, and you certainly paid us to enter. But if you're not going to act in a way that aligns with our values, then you don't get to do that anymore.
There's expectations that come with that. You know what's interesting, and it's somewhat aligned with what you just talked about, but I've been thinking about this a lot recently is I have 4 kids, and I probably didn't think about this as much as I was growing up, but as I kind of look back, I realize it more. I don't want to make this a conversation about teacher pay or volunteer coaching and things like that, but I have noticed the importance and impact, and this is going to seem like a no-duh statement, but how a teacher or a coach formatively in those formative years informs the success of your child in a specific sport, in a specific subject, in a specific area. What I mean by that is, if you're in elementary school and you're just kind of figuring out, do I like math? Do I like history? Do I like English? A lot of that is tied to the idea of how great of a teacher, how engaged that teacher is, how much they put into the lesson plan, how much they care, whether you become somebody that becomes a historian later on in life, or somebody that really is inclined towards math and ends up solving some of the biggest problems scientifically in the world. A lot of that can be traced back to it's great teaching, great education at a young age. Another one is coaching. And I think about it, and it's like I have a daughter and she's like excelling in soccer right now. But there was a 2-year gap there where she wasn't liking soccer, she wanted to quit. And it's because she had some coaches that were really more about not developing the players. They were not as focused on putting her in a position to be successful, kind of not building up her confidence. And she almost got out of the sport. And I'm so glad that we kind of kept on the path and that she's had some good coaches since then that have got her back on that track. And I just think a lot of it is so touch or go. And yet, when we look at teacher compensation, when we look at coaches who are volunteering, what an impact they have on all the kids that talk, they touch and reach and impact what they care about as they go forward. Again, I've always thought of myself as not great at math. Okay. Well, I gotta be honest with you. I probably didn't have the best math teachers when I was in elementary school. They didn't make me love it. It was something I felt like I was struggling with, and maybe they were reinforcing that. Additionally, I love politics and government at university, I had a teacher who was the campaign manager for Walter Mondale, and he was super engaging and amazing. And that has really informed my view on politics and government as I go forward. So I just find it so important and interesting when you talk about this community, but also the importance of education and the importance of the right teachers developing the right messages can just be so formative for how people have success later on in life. And I know I went on a little bit of a tangent there, but I realized the importance of that. And I love what you're doing at NewReach. I think it's such an important thing. And that's really what my biggest takeaway is from our conversation to that point. What about a community that resonated with you growing up? What was the most important community for you as you were growing? Maybe it was an elementary school, high school, maybe it was the military. What was the most important community for you?
It may sound a little bit trivial, but it was actually being an RA in college. And so had the opportunity, so I was a resident advisor in a small New Englander school, had the opportunity to live on a floor of a bunch of hooligans and try to help and guide them and make sure that everybody was safe. But also if they were going through life things to help them out. And so for that investment, I was given kind of room and board. But I would patrol the halls and make sure folks weren't drinking. There was a whole bunch of other things that I would try to manage through. But that experience gave me tremendous opportunity to learn. And so I could apply leadership all day, every day. If there was someone who's drunk in the hall and logic is not going to work with them to convince them to stop doing what they're doing, I had to figure out ways to do that. If there was a safety issue, I had to assess what the risk is, and then how do we mitigate that risk? And is it like there's really something that's going to go on, or there's the potential that something's going to be bad? And so, with massive amounts of data points, I was able to really learn as a practitioner, as a leader in the formative years as a college student. And I learned other really cool things. And so, we tried to figure out, is it more important to be consistent or be fair? And so, as we apply certain things, like which is more important? And so, at 19 years old, those were the debates that I was having. And so, I learned very quickly that I think is fair is more important than consistent, because there's always unique situations. And I think you can explain fair, but from a military perspective, consistent is certainly the easier way to go. I think in large corporations, consistency is the easier way to go. You ask for PTO, I told everybody they can't have PTO, so no. But wait, but my brother just died. Okay, I guess you're gonna have PTO. And so the pursuit of fairness really surfaces. And so being a resident advisor for 3 years in college gave me just a massive, massive data set of trying to lead and apply. And I was wrong many of the times, and I got really quick feedback. I was right many of the times, and I got quick feedback. But it's funny how often I take some of those really simple lessons that I learned between 19 and 22. And at 50 years old, I'm still trying to apply them, but I can remember like that's where I learned it. And so I think that was probably one of the most profound communities that I was a part of.
Wow, God bless you. What a thankless job. I think back to the way I treated my RAs back in college when I got to the University of Arizona. First time out of the house, first time feeling like an adult. That is not an easy job. So that is a really good lesson there. I appreciate you sharing that. I might have to write my RA from 25 years ago and thank him for his service because ultimately I was tough. Let's talk about your book because you wrote a book on the five pillars of talent management. I know there's a rewrite going out. I'm really interested. There's a lot of talent acquisition in it, so I know we're going to get into that in just a second. But I'm just interested. Tell us a little bit about the book and some of the pillars. I'm interested to know why you decided to write the book and what stands out about it.
Yeah. So I was trying to. So I actually started writing the book because I was a part of a mentorship group with Russell Brunson. And so it's a group of really profound thinkers in the marketing space. And so in the community that we have and in the mentorship group, we get together and we share kind of our best practices with each other. And so we give other people the best that we have. And then we ask them some questions about our business and they gift us with some advice. And so I am not a profound marketer. And so I was trying to figure out what I could provide to them that might be really helpful because many of them are in that startup to super small space. And so they're earning maybe $10 to $20 million a year, which is really good income. But now they're starting to have some of those problematic issues of how do I go from small to large? Hey, I'm the expert. I don't really want to manage. I want to go do this, or I do want to manage. And then I lose the subject expertise on this. And so that's how I originally wrote kind of the first document. It was a thank you to them. And so I just called it a primer in the five pillars of talent management. And so for me, I break it into five very different things. And so I look at talent identification, talent assessment, talent development, talent acquisition, and then talent retention. And so the kind of book is set up to kind of walk through how if I were a person who is starting a new business, how I set up talent management and include each of those five pillars to make sure that I know how much to pay people, how to assess them, how do I set up the right culture to hold them accountable for the growth that they believe that they want? How do I really determine if this hire is a tactical or a strategic hire? And so my hiring processes or my acquisition processes are going to be very different. And so in the last 25, 30 years, like I've learned a lot in that space. And so I originally wrote it as a gift to them. Then I got some feedback that maybe there's a couple other people out there that might actually enjoy it. And so I made it a little less specific towards that mastermind group. And so yeah, we're kind of in the second rewrite now. I think there'll be a third coming out relatively quickly. So
I love it. I got a shameless plug here. I know we worked together at RBI. MSH had done some of the recruitment process outsourcing in a very important time for them when 3G Capital came in. And as they started to acquire Tim Hortons and Popeyes, I'm very proud of the work that we did there. You actually referenced it in the book. Can you just give us a little small explainer on why you thought of that and why that came up and what specifically you were talking to?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually a product. And so I remember, I think it was Liza that was the talent acquisition person that onboarded me into RBI. You know, like it couldn't have been any better. She communicated me frequently enough, gave me what I needed to know to advance me along. At no point did I think that she was doing me favors or that she worked for me. Like it was crystal clear she was supporting the company. And that's the way that it should be. But she also made it clear that her job was to put the right type of people in front of the company and set me up for success in those conversations. And so I really appreciated that with her. Then when I joined the team, I got to see probably one of the best strategic uses of talent management in terms of setting up and using a leadership development track. That's the best I've seen in any company. And so the work that went into figuring out how to get maybe 30 or 40 college sophomores, juniors to come spend the summer with us, go spend a couple of weeks in the restaurants, and then go back and do some other opportunities with operations or marketing or finance, so that at the end of the summer, the company can say, "Hey, I really like you, and I need you to fill a talent that I'm going to have a year from now. So when you graduate, come back and be a part of this and continue this great journey." And so the concept of the LDP and doing that, I think there are many organizations that do it, but the way that MSH supported and kind of guided that was incredible because it was a year-long interviewing process. And as a person who worked at RBI and Burger King, I was accountable to participate in a ton of the interviews. It didn't matter if the person was going to work for me, I was responsible. And so it tied culture to talent acquisition in a way that I hadn't seen before. And I just thought it was phenomenal. But shamelessly, I really enjoyed working with a team that tried to actively fill my positions. And so, yeah, I thought your team was amazing. Catherine and Tomas, they were
You're making
awesome.
me cry. I'll tell you what, I really appreciate that. We put a lot of hard work into that account. They were very hard driving in that account. We learned a lot. You've worked in some tremendous organizations, so you're not just saying this, that this is something that you have context around. So I really appreciate that. There was a lot of great support from the people that work there in the talent space as well. And some of the people that were on that account still work here, some don't. I'm gonna have to reach out to everybody and thank them. That means a lot what you said, Curtis. I really appreciate it. All right, we got to pay the bills here. So we got to talk about talent acquisition. These lights don't stay on by themselves. So I want to make sure we dive into the talent acquisition portion. I got some questions for you here. Let's start with this. Core hiring philosophy, people that you want to bring into your organization, your team, what's kind of your core philosophy around that?
So I think the most important thing is to understand, is it a strategic hire or is it a tactical hire? And from that, I think you need to guide the acquisition process accordingly. And so for me, I think a strategic hire is something that as we're looking at what our business is going to be in 6 months, on the front side, if I can work with my talent acquisitions team to say, "Hey, in 6 months, we're going to start this new business, we're going to grow this," it gives them ample opportunity to go out and really work hard and find the right candidates so that we can put them in front of our hiring managers. And so I think we strategically look at it. And so in that, whenever we do that, we should be looking to continuously upgrade talent. And so we should find the best that there is in kind of that pay range that we can bring on. And so that means we should get an opportunity to look at multiple people and then figure out of those multiple people, which one do we want? And so in the philosophy, there's the strategic side. There's also the tactical side, which says, hey, someone transitioned yesterday. It's an important position. I actually have 8 of those on the company. I need another one. And it's a very important position, but I've got peers that can train it. We kind of know what it's going to do. And so I would say that's much more of a tactical hire. And so the speed that hire happens and the vetting process is probably already a little bit more refined. And so I would say that's tactical. But when I talk to our talent acquisition team, I need to be specific of, hey, this is a strategic, this is a tactical, because it guides their frame for how they go forward.
That's really good advice. If I ask you about a memorable interview experience, maybe one that you are giving the interview or you were somebody, you were the interviewee, what comes to mind when I ask you that?
So it's funny. I absolutely love interviewing. Like, I love applying for roles. I also love interviewing candidates because I think we can truly be honest. And if you do a good job, you communicate well. But it's funny. I don't know if you can see it behind me. Let me move my camera. But I have a quote here. It says, experience is a hard teacher because she gives the test first and the lesson afterward. Ooh, and like so that couldn't have been more true when I was interviewing with Walmart. And so I interviewed at the home office and then I went down to the field to interview with someone. And it was awesome. Like, we're in a kind of a conference room in the hotel and there's a group of 5 operators there. They start asking me a bunch of questions and they ask me a question about, hey, tell me about a time when you applied a strategy. And like, I am so excited about that question, Oz. Like, I'm going to crush it. I know exactly what I'm going to talk through. And I look around the room and everybody's got their pen just hovering over their paper. And I go through and I explain how when I was in Iraq, we were looking at satellite telecommunications and I found a different carrier rather than the satellite network we were using that was going to save us $20 million a year. And it was a backup network or a backup constellation that years ago cost way more, but now it was cheaper. And so I pushed that forward. It was great. We're going to save, like, we literally saved $20 million a year. At the end of that, like, I'm kind of like happy, like I'm proud of myself with that answer. And the pens are just hovering. And they kind of look around and then they go on to the next question. And so I give them another answer that I'm really proud of, and the pens just hover. And what I realized at the end of that was they were not going to write anything down until I started the story with, when I was a store manager, they were pure operators and they wanted stories that talk about how you operate stores. And so at first I was a little bit offended. Like, I was like, hey, maybe you just aren't really ready to receive what I'm offering. Then I really had a profound piece of wisdom from somebody who had been an SVP at a bank, but was very hot at Walmart. She asked me, she's like, how's the interviewing going? I told her, and she's like, oh, that's a perfect story. Never tell it again. I was like, okay. And so she explained to me that it's my job as the candidate to actually answer the question. It's not their job to interpret it. And so I was giving really good examples that had nothing to do with what the job was. And so I was a little put off that they didn't necessarily respect what I was offering, but it was really just my ignorance that I didn't know that it's my job to do that. And so that was one of the most memorable experiences that I had.
Did that happen midstream? Like, did that happen like in interview, or was it subsequent interviews afterwards you kind of had time to reflect, or did you kind of pivot midstream in the actual interviews you were given?
Nope. It took a while to get there. And if it wasn't for that person that I talked to later, I probably still wouldn't be there. And so I was very thankful for her.
That's amazing. What about a favorite question? Do you have a favorite question you like to ask in interviews?
I have 2, actually. The first question is, I love when somebody comes in and you just take the whiteboard marker and you give it to them and say, okay, you've got 40 minutes, go. And you don't ask a single question. Because at that point, either the person has prepared for the interview and they know what's going to be the most important to you. And so they're going to talk through the things that directly tie from their background to what the position is. And they're going to embed questions and they're going to do those things. And so I think that is by far the best way to go.
Like that.
Reality, Oz, I've never done that. but I really believe it's the most right way to go. In a question that I really ask that I think is the most effective, it's really simple, but it's, hey, what did you do this weekend?
What are you looking
and
for?
So
there?
If someone's like, oh, I was really stressed out, and so I just slept all weekend, and I know what they do, and it shouldn't be that stressful, I'm getting a tremendous amount of feedback. If they're like, oh, it was a really good weekend, I went for a hike, I spent some time with my dad, he's been in the hospital, blah, 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 I read a book, I went to this. Like, are they active on their weekend? Like, how do they use the time that they get to choose where it goes? And so it's a really simple question, which seems like just banter, but it's not. It's one of the most important questions that I ask because the way that they answer that tells me a lot about them. It also tells me, hey, are you prepared or are you only prepared when you think I'm going to ask you a behavioral-based question?
I love that.
It's a sticky one.
I love to throw the questions back at each other. We're gonna both answer. What'd you do this weekend?
So it was a wonderful weekend. I came into the office. I typically work on Saturdays and Sundays. And so I worked from 4 to 8 in the office on Saturday, from 4 to noon, and it was like 4 to 1 on Sunday. And then I went home and hung out with my wife. And so we started prepping for a vacation we're going to take, did laundry, but I got to spend time with her. I don't spend a lot of time with her. I'm never going to win a Husband of the Year award. By getting home by like noon or one in kind of that time frame, I still got to feel like I spent the whole day with her, but I still got 8 hours of work done. And so on Saturday and Sunday, I was able to spend 16 hours working on a project for a summit that we're going to have in April. And so it was a great investment of time. It scratched my professional itch, but I also spent really good family time.
I love that. All right, now I'm going to answer it. And what a setup, because I had a very unique weekend. So it was my wife's 40th birthday. I asked her a year ago, what do you want more than anything for your 40th birthday? We live in South Florida. So she's like, I want to be on a boat. I enjoy being on a boat with my friends, right? So I had been coordinating this entire weekend, Miami weekend, where we have some friends flying in from out of town. We have a bunch of couples that we went out with. So Friday night, Friday in the day, I got done with work early, started running around, got a cake, got everything prepped up for the next day. Then I took my four kids and my wife out to dinner, and we had a birthday cake and did all that. Then Saturday, we get up early, we head down to the hotel in Miami in Brickell, go to the boat in the marina, have a great day with our friends, get dressed, go out to a nice dinner in Miami. Then all the couples hung out, had a great time. Then woke up the next day, went to a brunch, and then I got home and we were both exhausted and probably fell asleep super early. But that was a weekend where I'm a lot of times doing what you're doing. I'm reading, I'm working out, I'm doing work. I actually look at my weekends as my time to cool down and restart for another work week is typically what I'm doing. So sometimes I'm not in that husband of the year conversation as well. But this weekend was one where I absolutely had to put all the focus in to my wife on a very special birthday. I think she had a great time. And so that's what I did this weekend. Did I get the job?
You did.
Amazing. Can't wait to
Nice
start.
work.
So, all right, next question. How do you create a great candidate experience, but a realistic one for people that are interviewing with you and your team? How do you let them know what to expect, good and bad, and what it's like to work for Curtis or work in your organization?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to it. I think it really starts with the talent acquisition manager that talks to them on the front side. They should make it explicitly clear what is going to happen. If we do that with everybody, then we're fair and consistent. And so, if everybody knows what's going to happen, these are the types of questions that you're going to ask. These are the people that you're going to meet with. These are the roles that they're in. I don't even care if they tell them, hey, typically they're looking for these things, but just do it for everybody because I want to know their best. And so, if they're misaligned in terms of what they think that I want to hear about, that's going to be problematic for them and it's going to be kind of a waste of time for me. And so, I'm fine if the talent acquisition team over communicates what the day or the time is going to be. And so, I think it starts there. On the flip side, what I need to do is I need to give them an opportunity to share with me what they've been great at, as well as share an opportunity for them to tell me how what they've done applies to what I need done. Third part to it, I need to make sure that at the end of the day, they want the job. And so, Oz, it may sound a little bit weird, but I don't think that the purpose of the interview is to hire someone. I think the purpose of the interview is to have someone say they want to work for you and for you to make the choice of, hey, I like this candidate and I like other candidates and now I get to choose. Otherwise, the first person that we said, hey, I think they could do the job, we would hire, but I don't know that that's necessarily the best practice. And so I'm not trying to string people along, find 15 people and figure out what I want, but I don't think the purpose of the interview is specifically, I just need to hire them. What I want is for them to be a great candidate with the skills that we need. And so they've got the skills, they've got the culture, it's the right path for them, and they want to work for us. And so then I can decide rather than, hey, I don't know if they want to work for us, but I want them. And so it's a little bit of a different
Yeah,
way
it
to look at
completely
it.
reframes in your mind how you approach it and how you go about it. I think that's really smart. What about when you miss? Because we all miss from time to time. So do you look back and is there a theme that you say, I wish I would have done this, or I didn't dig in, or is it maybe you were previously hiring because they could do the job, when now you've got this different philosophy. What happens when you miss, when you look back and reflect?
I typically miss for one of two reasons. The first is the easiest, and so I'll be brief on that, is that I don't have the technical skills to truly assess them. And so I'm currently looking for a chief information officer to join our company. I don't actually know how to assess them to determine, are they actually that strong technically to be able to guide and advance our business in terms of saying, this is what you do. These are all the technologies that are out there that you're not even thinking about. But if we include those, you can advance your business. Like, I'm not smart enough in that space or not experienced enough in that space to do a great job in that. And so I feel like in some ways I'm underserving. And so there have been a few of those positions in my career that it's my responsibility to hire them. I do the best that I can. But since I don't know and I'm not an expert in that space, I might get some misses from there. More often, the ones that I think are a little bit more problematic is when the person doesn't fully understand what the role is, that they've been told something different by the talent acquisitions manager than maybe what the hiring manager believes and then what I believe. And so they're in an unfair position because it seems like they're having three different interviews for three different jobs. And so when we don't do a good job of clearly outlining, these are the expectations. And so I even break it mathematically into, hey, this role, it's 20% strategic, it's 50% operational, 30% tactical. Okay, great. So if what you're looking for is a strategic position where you want to spend 90% of your time developing marketing strategy, that's not the right role for you. And so I need to be as explicit as I can, because when I say, hey, there's strategic, operational, and tactical components, if I'm not clear in that, I'm going to have misalignment. And so I may bring somebody on who has great talent, but they've just made a massive life change. They've left a role, they've turned down other roles, they've physically moved here, and things are wrong. And so those are the things that I really try to engineer out, because I've had some misses at kind of some lower levels on that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. That's a really smart way to look at it. I think most of the time, maybe sometimes our understanding of what we need in the role is misaligned in our own head. And now we go about asking the wrong questions. And now you're definitely setting some things up for failure. But it certainly has, it's a two-way street at the end of the day. It has to be a situation where that person understands what they're walking into. And that's why that candidate experience, that realistic job preview is so key. But a lot of times I've noticed the same thing. Either I didn't have a full understanding of what the key behaviors and attributes and capabilities were of the role, or I didn't do a good enough job articulating it. And so the person stepped into the role not realizing what they were walking into. So I think that's really, really good advice. Let's take this a little bit of a different direction. What are you working on right now that you're really excited about? Anything that really gets you up out of bed in the morning?
Yeah, it so to be honest, that every day I get excited to serve our students. I get excited about the opportunity to bring new students into our ecosystem to kind of help them change their lives and let them go unleash that inner entrepreneur. And so, like, I'm pretty simple. Like, I'm happy with what I do. I'm proud of it. I think it has a very positive impact on society. A couple of bigger projects that we're working on. So again, you pointed to the book. It'll be good to kind of get with a publisher and figure out if anyone actually wants to read it, or if it's just maybe you
I
and your
want to read it.
wife.
I know that you got at least one person buying. I'll promise you that.
Nice. And so it's really fun, and it's kind of one of those passion projects to invest, hey, what I've learned and how do I make it easier for someone else. And so that's been good. The second thing that I'm working on is just super, super fun. We've spent the last year building up for what is called the Squad Up Summit. And so it's going to be in Orlando between the 23rd and the 25th of April. It's kind of an environment where people who have that inner entrepreneurial spirit and they want to figure out how to grow and develop and be their boss and figure out how to propel their lives that way. We're going to show them many tricks and traits on how to do that. We're going to say that, or we believe that real estate investing is foundational in that. And so most people who achieve a certain status in life that says, hey, I'm where I belong or I deserve to be or where I want to be, real estate investing has helped them along the way. And so it's going to be three incredible days with Pace Morby, Jamil Damji, and a host of other really good keynote speakers to talk through for three straight days on, hey, this is the masterclass for how you can get from here to there. And it's been so much fun preparing, because we know that it's like folks buy tickets and they come and they use some vacation time to get there. And so we know that it's a heavy investment on our part. So that's why it's been so much fun for us for the last year to build out what that's going to be to make it so that we can hopefully blow their mind. And so again, we'll probably have about 3,000 people in Orlando in April. And so if you want to come up, do it. We'd love to see you.
Hey, listen, it's not far from you. You got to let me know how it goes. I'm really excited to hear it. It sounds like you're putting a lot of work into it. It sounds like it's going to be a great event. So definitely send me some more details on that. Any great book you've read recently, or any content, really anything? If you've seen something on Netflix, some interesting movie, anything that you want to shout out or speak to that our listeners might need to pick up?
Yeah, it's funny. There's a book that I touch really often, and I learn so much from it every time I look at it. And so the book's called Drive by Daniel Pink, and so it ties
Amazing.
to a concept. Excuse me.
I read that. Amazing book. Keep going.
It what I love most about it is for it was 20 years in the making where I. A former snowboarder, whitewater kayaker. I definitely played hard, rock climbed. And we always talk about flow from a recreational perspective. And so the idea of I find this space where I'm at my most me. And so it sounds really fun to think about it on going over a waterfall or really carving it up on the mountain. But no one ever talked about it at work. And so for 20 years, I was really irritated because I felt more flow at work than snowboarding, kayaking, running, you name it. Like I found that at work. And so I think that was the first place where someone said you can find that in your professional life. And so it's a book that I read forever ago, but I touch it really often just because it lets me focus as a leader to say, how do I help others find more flow when they're at work?
Okay.
And so.
Great book. That really was informative for me too, because I would notice that I would be in these states where I was doing my best work, where I was making the best decisions, where I felt the best and most productive, but they were intermittent. And so what I had to realize is, and what that book kind of helped me clear in my head was, how do I get into that zone more often than not? What are the characteristics of when I'm in that zone? What has happened? And so through different things like meditation and right eating right and right sleep and just the type of work, like what's my Ekaji zone, or the things that I love that I'm best at and I get the most out of, how do I tie that all together? I've really started to even build my work structure around a lot of those philosophies and just spending the time where I feel best and I do my best work, and then putting people around me that pick up the gaps of the things that are not my best place. So that's, I love that. Great book, great recommendation. Last question. If you had to give one bit of advice to, Curtis early in his career, or maybe somebody who's early in their career right now listening to this that you didn't know then, but that you know now, what would it be?
Be here now. And it's something that a leader shared with me probably in the late 1990s. And so I had graduated college, graduated grad school, and I was stationed at Wright-Patterson in Dayton, Ohio. And I worked for a senior civilian, and she was absolutely amazing. And she challenged me and she said, "Hey, Curtis, she was very kind. She's like, you're a talented leader. You're always going to have people that want you to go work for them. You're always going to have people that say, hey, you could go do this. You're going to be tempted by a ton of other things." She's like, "But what you need to do is you need to be here now. So whatever role you're in right now, you need to be the best you can be at that role." And I think there's two parts to it. One, I think it's fulfillment of the contract that you said you were going to be here. And so you should. And so this, no one should take a job saying, "Hey, I'm taking this as a stepping stone." Like it should be a real job, and I'm going to commit everything that I have to it. The other thing that I learned, and so I think she knew it, but I didn't understand it for probably a decade, is there are times in our life when we are in a spot where we can learn things. And so the things that I was learning then as a technician, I don't have time to learn now. And so if I didn't learn those things in kind of my late 20 or my mid to late 20s, I was never going to have another role as a technician that lets me become an expert at that. And so her focus of be here now was super, super important to me. And so I have embraced that for a very long time. And every role that I'm in, I'm truly not thinking about what the next role is. I'm here now, embracing the fact that I'm learning and earning. And it's amazing. And I'm thankful for it. And I'm trying to serve. But if I'm here now, I can do it justice. And so.
Love that. Be here now. You have done an incredible job of being in this moment right now for our podcast. You had some incredible insights, some things I'm definitely going to remember. I know our listeners are going to love this episode. So I really appreciate you coming on, Curtis. I'm looking forward to staying in contact, and thank you so much. Have a good one.
Oz, it's been really fun. It's good to reconnect. Thank you very much.